Life confronts us with the unexpected. Welcome to Curveball, a podcast about how we deal with life's biggest challenges and oftentimes unimaginable experiences, as told through stories of people who have done it. Now, here's your host, Scott Reich.
Parts of today's conversation with the once nationally known diver Cliff DeVries left me speechless. He was at the top of his game diving at the University of Kentucky, planning for his Olympic debut, when a massive spinal cord and lower brain stem tumor was discovered. Take a listen to a comeback story for the ages. Cliff DeVries defied all odds, including a marathon surgery that lasted half a day, where he was temporarily pronounced dead. Cliff DeVries, thanks so much for coming on Curveball.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Obviously, you've had a big curveball that we will get to, but before we get there, I'd love for you to share with the audience a little bit about who you are. Where do you come from? What was childhood like?
Sure. Well, I grew up in upstate New York in a little town called Henrietta. I actually grew up in a fantastic place for little kids. So in a little neighborhood called Riverton, and had walkways that went all through the neighborhood, which weren't roads, little play areas. And we had a pool there as well, a community pool. So just a great place to grow up. So I'm from a family of six. I'm the youngest. So my two parents and the six kids were eight people all stuffed in a little house. We had fun and exciting and a very happy childhood. You know, I was always getting beat up because I was the youngest.
I was going to ask where in the order. You were the baby. Okay. Yes. I'm the oldest of four, which always felt busy and chaotic. So I can't totally grasp six, but that's quite an experience. What was the age range from oldest to youngest?
My older brothers are 20 years older than me. So quite a big range. So that made things very interesting.
I'll bet. So you did mention the community pool there, and I think that's a great segue, obviously, into one of your great passions. You became a terrific athlete, and you were pursuing your passion for swimming. Walk us through that a little bit of just what it was like to get involved in diving and to pursue the sport that you loved.
When I was really little, all my older brothers and sisters were over in the deep end. There's three separate pools. There's a little baby pool. There's a lap pool, you know, a racing pool, which was about 3 or 4 feet deep and maybe 5 or 6 feet deep at the lower end. And then there was a diving pool, and it was kind of shaped like a teardrop. And all my brothers and sisters would go over and they would be playing in the diving pool. And of course, I was the youngest. I didn't even know how to swim yet. So I kept on trying to follow them over. But my parents said, you can't go in the deep end until you know how to swim. So I learned how to swim just so that I could go over into the diving pool and dive with my brothers and sisters. That kind of started my love for diving. And every summer we'd go over to the diving well, or I'd go over to the diving pool there, and I would spend all day diving on that board. And it was great. And of course, I'm kind of a natural show off. And so I always tried to learn the new tricks and play around, but it was never anything really formal, no formal training, just kind of playing around. And so that was the most fun I had every year. Just
before we advance the story, I want to ask this question. So you mentioned a moment ago that you're sort of a natural show off. Did birth order have a role in that? Or do you feel that's just basic biology? What shaped you?
It's probably a combination of both, where, you know, I kind of had to push my way, fight my way to the dinner table to make sure I got some food. And then also, I think just a natural show off where, you know, I just like performing for my brothers and sisters and for kind of anybody who was around. Yeah, when I started diving and going into that pool, you know, I always looking around, okay, who's watching? Because I'm going to do a good one now.
Paint the picture for us, for those who are not as aware of all the specifics of diving. How high of a diving board are we talking about? And at what age are you starting to jump off this thing?
It's only about 3 feet off. It's a recreational board, so it doesn't have an exact height like a competition board that you would have at a college or a university or anything like that. But, you know, about 3 feet off the ground, so it wasn't that high. Yeah, so I wasn't really introduced to a high board until, you know, I was about 13 or 14. We would get a little bit on one, but not competitively. When we were kids, you know, there was a local community college which had a higher board. But so pretty small at that time when I was 5, 6, 7, 8.
Sure. Let's push the story forward a little bit. You mentioned you're an early teenager. Now, as I understand it, you started diving competitively, and this became not only a passion, but an outlet for great athleticism. And you were starting to not only show off, but I think impress a lot of people. So tell us a little bit more of the story of how you became somebody who was obviously, you know, recognized. And I say obviously because I know your story, but for those who are less familiar, please share.
Sure. A friend of mine came up to me one day and said, hey, are you going to join the diving team in high school? I said, we don't have a diving team. I know we've got swimmers, but we don't have a diving team. No, we've got a diving team. And the swim coach teaches the divers as well. I'm like, wow, this is the best thing I've ever heard of. So I went with him to a practice and I just loved it. And that's when I met my coach, Coach Young. So I progressed very quickly. And after a few months, the friend that brought me in, he quit, but I was still diving. And there were about four or five kids on the team, and all of them were much older than me, much stronger and much better divers. But of course, I was used to that situation with my older siblings, and I just jumped right in and fought my way up to the top. And so after my first year in a little regional competition, I came in 15th. So basically, I was almost last in that regional competition after my first year. And then after my second year,
well, you kept going, which is impressive. You make me think of one of my favorite movie scenes. I think it was the sequel to Meet the Parents, where Robert De Niro is in Ben Stiller's childhood home. And he's like, oh, I didn't know they made, ribbons for 9th place in horseback riding. He goes, oh, yeah, they go all the way to 10.
Yeah. And that's where I was. I was at the bottom of the pack. I don't think anybody really thought that I was anything special, but I was determined to make my way, and I was going to be a diver. That's what I was going to do. And so I read an article about Greg Louganis in Sports Illustrated. I'm like, wow, not only is this a great sport, but the U.S. is really, really competitive. And U.S. had had more divers win medals than any other country in the world at that point. Back in the 80s, it was really exciting. Diving was growing, and I loved it. And I would find any time I could to get on the boards. My dad gave me a membership to Rochester Institute of Technology, which of course I've got a long history with now. But at that time I went there and I rode my bike 5 miles up and down hills. And I know it sounds like the old story, but
I'm glad you said up and down, because usually
it was up and down hills, but it was a tough ride. I'd ride my bike all the way to the pool just so I could get a couple hours of diving time in. And by my sophomore year, I was undefeated except for one competition. And then by my junior year, I was ranked in the top 30 in the country. In my senior year, I was receiving scholarship offers from several universities. So it was a fast ride.
If I understand the story correctly, at some point you were trying to execute certain dives and you were experiencing challenges. You were feeling that you couldn't physically get to do exactly what you wanted to do. And it led you to some medical appointments. Can you walk us through what that journey was like?
Sure. During my first year in college, so I got a scholarship to the University of Kentucky. And in my first semester, I started feeling a lot of weakness in my right arm. And my coach kept on telling me, hey, get your arms up. And I'm like, I'm trying. My arms just aren't getting up. So after that point, I wasn't really competitive, dropped out of school. Then I went on a mission for 2 years. I didn't really know what was going on with my arm. It wasn't getting better.
What kind of mission was it?
It was a Mormon mission. So I was on a mission for my church. So it was a proselyting mission where I go through and teach people about the gospel. But it was 2 years and I was in Argentina. My shoulder wasn't getting better. When I got back, I was having a lot of difficulty. I couldn't sleep. I was throwing up all the time. And the weakness in the arm got worse and worse. And went into the doctor and I thought, there's got to be a pinched nerve in my arm, because I was in great shape and I couldn't think of anything else that it could be. So I went into the doctor's office. They ordered an MRI. I got an MRI. And when I was in the tube in the MRI machine, they said, how's everything going? I'm like, hey, great. How does everything look? They pulled me out of the tube. And I remember looking up at the nurse and seeing her face was totally white. And I'm like, this is going to be terrible. So they put me back in. They finished the MRI and went through, and the next day I got the results and my parents said, hey, we need you to come home from work early. And I was actually coaching some divers at my former high school. And so I came home and they said, you need to sit down. I said, I don't need to sit down. I'll be fine. What is it? And they said, you've got to sit down. They said, Cliff, you're going to die. You've got a 6-inch long tumor in your spinal column, which is pressing up against your brainstem. And you've only got a few months to live. And so I was happy that they told me to sit down.
I'm hearing you tell this story. And even just to that point, I mean, the scene you're describing is incredibly emotional, right? I mean, your parents are sitting you down to tell you that you're going to die and that you don't have that much longer to live. I mean, I can't even imagine what must have been going through your mind in this moment.
of course, everything kind of blurs. You don't have really focus on anything. You can't, it's too much to process. You're thinking, what options do I have? What should I be doing here in my last few weeks and months? The one thing that was very comforting to me was that I just served a faithful mission. I believed in God, and I knew that I had lived a good life up to then. And so if I was going to go, that's not a terrible time to go. And so I had a lot of peace at that time from that. No matter how horrible that news was, I still felt a good amount of peace that whatever happened was going to be okay for me.
And how old were you at this time?
I was 21.
21. It's incredible. And when you think about that you may have weeks or months to live, it's one thing to feel that sense of peace. Were there other things that you felt? Did you feel this is unfair? Did you feel, I'm not sure that this really makes a lot of sense? I mean, what were the things that you were saying, I want to do in my remaining time when you were handed this awful diagnosis?
So, I mean, the first thing was, of course, I didn't believe it. I thought, there's no way. I'm an elite athlete. There's no way that I'm going to die. So I tried to kind of dismiss the possibility that I had the chance of dying. And so then I thought, well, you know what? All these very smart people are saying that I don't have too long. I better start thinking about what I'm going to do. Fortunately, that didn't last too long because in the coming weeks, I was able to meet with a neurologist who said that there was a surgeon down in New York City who was performing experimental surgeries on cancer patients with cancer in their brainstem. So that gave me a lot of hope. I thought, well, this is basically my only option. And so we went ahead, went down to New York City, and then Dr. Epstein performed this surgery. He's passed away now, but it was a 13-hour long surgery where they opened up, they cut away a lot of my spinal column so that they could get into the spinal cord where the cancer was. They removed 90% of it, and luckily it was an extremely slow-growing tumor. And so the 10% that's still there is not growing removed, so it has remained stable for the past 30 years.
And I think you're partly condensing this because my understanding also from some of the research that I did is that the surgery was not quite so simple. I mean, you referenced that it was a long surgery, but if I recall correctly, you may have even almost died on the table given the complexities. Could you walk us through what that was?
During the surgery, they were very optimistic. In fact, before the surgery, they said, we think that you're going to be able to walk out of here and you're going to be fine after this. They were very confident. But then during the surgery, they had all the equipment fail. So, and I wasn't sure if that was me dying, and the doctors don't know. And at this point, nobody really knows if I actually died on the table or if all of the machinery that they had failed recording my life vitals. So, and I didn't have a near-death experience. I didn't see a light or anything like that. And so the only recollection I have is the anesthesiologist giving me my first shot and going out and then waking up in the elevator on a gurney with the transporter moving me around. And so I don't have any recollection of that part, but they did lose me during the middle of the surgery.
It's unbelievable. Okay. So now you're after the surgery. What's recovery like? What are you able to do? What are you not able to do? Tell us about coming out of this experience.
Yeah, the most miserable and horrible pain that you can imagine, being intubated and being awake and conscious while there's a large tube down your throat and a pump in your lungs, it's horrible. I wouldn't wish that. And during COVID, when I heard about the dozens, hundreds, and even thousands of people who were intubated and on breathing machines, it was unbelievable for me. Yeah, not being able to eat when they couldn't feed me. They put a feeding tube up my nose, but it didn't fit. And so they had to break my nose to be able to get the feeding tube down into up my nose and down into my stomach. And yeah, it was a miserable, horrible experience. Completely paralyzed from the neck down. This is a little bit graphic, but when the pus and everything would gather in my throat, I would just have to burble it out and it would drain all over my face and my body. And it was miserable. I can't imagine something worse than somebody going through that and that, but I know it does happen a lot.
Yeah. This is quite a curveball. Obviously, you know, we're on a podcast called Curveball, and you know my story a little bit about what I've gone through with my son, and no story is the same, no journey is the same. hearing what you have gone through is something that I think moves anybody, right? Especially if they or a loved one have been through trauma and experience. So I credit you for simply just persevering. Tell us about the last 30 years. You went on from this horrific experience and near death, whatever we want to call it, to wind up figuring out how you were going to try to use your body in new ways and how you were going to still live an active life, which I think is tremendously heroic and, you know, in a personal way. So could you tell us, how did you go from being on that gurney and having these really uncomfortable and painful, excruciating experiences, you described them, to living a full and meaningful life as you essentially made yourself do?
Sure. I'll go back to my high school coach, Coach Young. And, you know, you learn a lot of great lessons in sports. And one of them is you never give up and you take one dive at a time. And so when you go into a competition, you don't want to be thinking about all the dives that you're going to be doing and what's going to happen. You just go and you take one dive at a time. And so when I got out and every day during those painful days, I thought, well, I'm just going to take one day at a time and I'm not going to give up. Then one other experience changed me. And I think this is so important and kind of the turning point for probably my whole life is right before one competition, I had slipped off the board and scraped up my leg. And then right after that, there was a team meeting with the whole team. Coach Young told everybody, he said, all right, tomorrow's a big meet and it's going to be very, very close. And it's going to depend on every one of you. And he said, at the end, he said, and we don't know how Cliff is going to do because of his bad leg. He's like, so everybody's got to pull their weight. And so I remember at that point that he had extremely high expectations for my performance. And also the rest of the team was relying on me. And so now whenever I go into anything, I think, you know what? I have to have very high expectations of my performance. And I have to think about the people who are around me who are relying on me. And having those two things in mind as I went through my recovery, and also as I went through the rest of my career up to this point, I always think, all right, I need to take care of those people who are around me. And there's very high expectations of the things that I do. And so when I started my recovery, I couldn't move. I was totally paralyzed. I was in a wheelchair and I had no movement on my right or left arm. Eventually, I was able to regain the strength a little bit in my leg. And of course, my right leg has never really completely recovered. It remains pretty much locked. And then my right arm has been completely paralyzed. And so I'm basically running on half my body as I walk and do all of my coaching and all of my administrative work as well.
Wow. It's unbelievably moving. And I just want to react to a couple of things you said there that really resonated with me and that I think will resonate with our audience. The first is that piece where you said that you're not going to give up and you're going to force an outcome. And I think that that is just such a personification of the human spirit, right? The ability to leverage our courage and muster up the energy to try to get out of a bad spot and, you know, keep moving forward. I love that tenacity. And, you know, I don't think that's merely as an athlete. I think that's just as you as a person, right? Which is so remarkable and something I admire. You know, the other piece also that I'm struck by in a couple of different ways is your comment that you feel this responsibility from Coach Young inspiring you and your teammates in inculcating in each of you the sense that you not only have to pull your weight, but maybe even a little bit extra because of those who may be around you who are vulnerable or maybe not able to pull their weight in the normal way or in a way that you might expect or that they might expect or desire. That's really incredible because what that tells me about you is that you're working within parameters that have been given to you to a degree, right? That life has brought to you. And yet you're still looking to excel. You're still looking to help people. You're still looking to be bigger than you as one person. And you've had certainly the experiences and excuses, if you will, to not have that mentality. And I think that's so important. I want to ask you, how has that outlook shaped, you know, all of your years since then? Because I imagine that that's been part of what has not only made you a survivor, but given you a quality of life that is meaningful, right? Like you're impacting people's lives every day. And I want you to comment also, obviously, on what you're doing these days so that our audience knows. But again, I want to talk about how that outlook has enabled you, that positive outlook has enabled you to achieve so many things that you have.
Well, first of all, thank you. You're very kind, and I really appreciate your kind words. Of course, I'm not perfect, and I don't always make the right decisions, but I do always try to think about the responsibilities that I have to myself and to others. Right now, I coach in two different areas. I coach a club team, which is called Upstate New York Diving, and I also coach a collegiate team at Rochester Institute of Technology. Kind of in a third capacity, I'm also an administrator for the Professional Diving Coaches Association. I work as the CEO, and I know it's a big title, but I just basically talk to a couple people and try to get them to join the organization. But as far as the success that I've had with Upstate New York Diving for 3 years from 2017, 2018, and 2019, we're the AAU national champion. So that's the largest organization of diving in the United States. And we won the national championship. And so we're the only organization that's ever won it 3 years in a row. There hasn't been another club that's done that. And then at the collegiate level, I've had 13 All-Americans, which is a lot of success at the collegiate level as well. So tremendously lucky and blessed career in diving and worked with some amazing athletes. And we've had a lot of fun.
I believe that one of the traditions that has been going on for a long time now is that annually you take a dive yourself. Could you tell us what that's like?
Sure. That's the highlight of my year. I make sure that we've got a couple lifeguards in the water and ready to go. And I climb up the ladder, walk out onto the board, and I do my annual dive. And so my son has walked me out many times on the end of the board. And now the head swim coach is a good friend of mine. We grew up together as well. We were on the same high school team. Phil Baratelli, he walks me out, and it's an amazing feel. You know, it's really hard to describe, because all in that 1.5 seconds, 1 second that I go into the water, there's just 1,000 memories that come back, all flooding into my head as I feel myself hitting the water, the impact of the water, and going down and smelling the chlorine and filling the water, fill up my ears just like it used to. And it's just a great, great experience for me every year. And I love it.
For those listening or watching, if you Google Cliff, you can see videos of some of these dives. They're very moving to watch. Cliff, I want to talk also a little bit about some of the emotional and social challenges that come with having different abilities. In other interviews, I've heard you describe that some of your friendships have changed, some for the worse, some for better, new friendships and so forth. Could you comment a little bit about how this journey has shaped who the people are who are around you and how you engage with them?
Yeah, I have a group of close friends. Of course, my family is the closest to me, and my wife is just a phenomenal person, an amazing woman, and a tremendous wife. We've raised a family together.
Do you want us to lead with that line? Cliff wants to acknowledge that his wife is terrific. And
absolutely. That would be the best header of the whole thing. She's just tremendous. And her workload is doubled because I'm able to do the dishes, and that's about it. So she does a tremendous amount for the family and taking care of me. If I can't get a sock on, she's right there helping me out. And you know, I'm fairly independent, but she still does a huge amount. My daughter is amazing. My sons are terrific. And of course, when you do have a serious life-altering injury like I did, things change with everybody. And so there's some people who you draw very close to. My great friend, Phil, he's the head swim coach, and he's gone out of his way to make sure that I have everything I need to be able to do well in the diving pool at RIT, as well as, you know, in my career. And so a lot of wonderful people in my life that helped me. And, you know, I try to do anything I can with them.
And that's something, Cliff, that hits home with me also, because in the context of my son's diagnosis, we started a 501c3 nonprofit called Believe in a Cure. We're trying to develop a treatment for his condition to help him and the other children who were afflicted by this brain disease. And one thing that has struck me on this journey is that there are some people who disappoint or move away. There's sort of a feeling of maybe they just are uncomfortable. Maybe they don't know how to engage. Maybe they don't want to engage. I don't ask people, obviously. And yet there are so many people who step up in unexpected ways and in all different types of ways too. It doesn't necessarily just have to mean somebody's donating to a charity, for example, but also providing emotional support. And one of the things that I have found, and I wonder if this is something that hits home with you too, is that so much of our lives in my family is centered around what's going on with my son that, you know, we want people to check in, certainly, but we don't want to only be defined by that experience of him having, you know, the inability to do most things, right? And to have an atypical childhood. Yes, it's a huge part of us, but a big part of what we try to promote in our household and what means something to us is having quote unquote regular type experiences that are not centered on the challenge, the trauma, the curveball. As we near the end of our interview, I would love to ask you also for people who are going through challenge. And as I said before, people have all different types of journeys. No two journeys are the same, but there is a sense of community. And that's what we're seeking to build here with this podcast, in helping people to just appreciate that we're not alone in our curveballs, that it is a common human experience to go through different types of challenge. What kind of message might you share with people to help them get through a difficult time if they're dealing with a big curveball or they have dealt with one?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. That's fantastic. And, I'm pulling for you and your family and your son. And at the beginning of, I'd say the middle, you know, when I was out and I kind of looked around, I said, well, all these people are looking at me and, you know, it's just difficult because they don't understand. They don't know what I'm going through. And then I'm not sure what it was, but I realized that, you know what? It's not about them. It's about me and how I look for opportunities and look at people and look at the world. And so I started seeing people who they opened up the door for me and were helping me in ways that I might not have even seen. I would go out sometimes during a snowy day and my car would be cleaned off and people moving out of the way and just tapping people who might have been my way so that I had a clear path when I'm walking through. You know, all these little kind gestures all around me everywhere. And when that vision changed to what are all these things that are going wrong, to look at all these amazing people who are around me and that I meet every day, it really, really changed my outlook. And for those people who are out there who might not know what to do, I think two things. Number one is that I have to invite people to help me in my life. And that's a big thing. So when I invite people, say, hey, you know what? Could you grab this for me? Hey, could you go over and take care of this? You have to invite people to help you out. And that makes everybody's life much easier. They understand where you're coming from and they don't feel awkward about it. And then just having that outlook that, you know what? There are really, really great people out there. And if your eyes are open, you will see them and they will be a part of your life.
I love that. You know, you're also just, you're hitting right in my heart, because one of the things that has happened for us on this journey also is the idea that we think differently about what we see. And to a degree, what so much of life before our curveball was the look outward, right? And I think that one of the transformational aspects of it is the fact that we are confronted with the challenge, but also the opportunity and blessing to look inward and to think about who we are and how we choose to see the world. So Cliff, thank you for saying that. And Cliff DeVries, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's an incredible story and we're delighted to have had you on.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you and all that you do, and good luck to you and your family, and I hope everything continues to go well there in Long Island.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
What's striking about Cliff is his ability to normalize his curveball. He's once again at the top of his game as a diving coach, walking when he was told he'd never walk again, and he's grateful for everything he wished never happened. If you are listening and dealing with the unexpected right now, know that Cliff came back from a death sentence. In the words of Winston Churchill, if you're going through hell, keep going. Thanks for listening to this episode of Curveball.
Thanks for listening to Curveball with Scott Reich. We hope you found meaning, insights, and even encouragement in today's episode. We love hearing from you. Please share your questions and suggestions for guests at scott-reich.com and on Instagram at curveball_podcast.